Convict Files, and I am Al, and Theo may be joining us later. It's not quite clear, but everything's all right. And with us, again, is Eric the Blacksmith. We're doing Phantasms of Freedom, Part 9.
Part 9. Hello, Al.
Hello. Could this become a 30-parter? Who knows?
I don't know. Now, who did you do 30 parts with?
Larry the Contractor Guy.
That's right.
I think that one's 30.
Okay, yeah.
So, I didn't even start. I never counted with Colvin, so, you know. Forget that. There's probably a million of them, and Adam also, go rightly.
Right.
You had sent something a couple of weeks ago, and I didn't get a chance to talk to you last week. But it came from, I guess it's a thesis or part of a thesis or something from that University of Georgia.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I'm referring to? About the Whiskey Rebellion?
Vaguely, yes. Yep.
And I sent two paragraphs along to JQ, and I didn't get a chance to talk to him about it, but it kind of affirms what JQ presents as to the attitude not of the regular hoi polloi, but of the elites. And that paper that I'm referring to states that the fact that the elites had this kind of distaste or repugnance for, like, the little people. So in one sense, I mean, what this white paper does is show that class distinction. And JQ, not because he believes in the elite's attitude toward the citizenry, but it just confirms what they're saying, and those are in the writings that he's brought to the table too. So I had a laugh because really it's very much supported what this gentleman said in that PDF that you sent along. And I just want to read these two graphs real quick. And I thank you for them because that was excellent. And that PDF, I think, also is accessible. I'll have to put it back up again.
Yeah, if you need the link, I can resend it. And it is The Whiskey Rebellion of 1794. I do have it in front of me now. A Democratic Working Class Insurrection by a Wythe Holt. It's one of the best researched and most heavily footnoted articles I've ever read in my life.
I just want to share this with the listeners, and this is your fine. I want everybody to understand that. But I just got a kick out of those two paragraphs because, man, whew. So let me just get into it real quick as I beg your indulgence.
Go for it.
All right. So as mainstream historians today, conservative or liberal, perpetuate at least two falsehoods about the past of the United States. First, they say that the Constitution of 1787 and the government established under it represent fulfillment of the goals which most Americans had in throwing off the British yoke and establishing a new nation. They deny that a more democratic vision was held by any of the revolutionaries, and they claim that the new government was and is a democracy. Second, they say that class antagonisms do not characterize the history of the United States. A material history of the Whiskey Rebellion shows the contrary. Those on the bottom of the American society in the 1780s and 1790s envision a democratic and egalitarian world very different from that which the Federalists desired and produced. And they saw themselves as an oppressed class opposed to, quote, the few, unquote, who monopolized power and ran matters for themselves in the new nation. And that's paragraph one. Before I go to two, are there any thoughts banging around in your head about this? Because I'd like to get your take on just that paragraph, if you have one.
It further solidifies what, at least to me, the informer in Montgomery said about many of these things. And it's yet another avenue. Here's another field of research. Here's another research who basically came to the same conclusion that the informer in Montgomery did. And I'd consider what the research that this guy did was almost on a par, if not on a par, to what the informer looked into. So I'd have to say that everything that he did, the informer, it's all checked out. And it seems like every time I look into this history, I'm finding further verification, further buttressing of that. And it's the same as it's always been, Al. It's the elites taking advantage of the workers.
All right, I could hear some people moaning in their seats about just how bad do we have it, and I understand that. I really do. But we'll get into that later. So in the second paragraph, it says, these mainstream accounts of early United States history, in general, refuse to acknowledge the weakness of the nation in the 1790s or the elitist anti-democratic nature of most post-revolutionary American political leadership or the viciousness and deviousness which characterized the Washington administration when it was threatened, or the class warfare which that administration waged against those who were in who were to bear the brunt of development as envisioned by Hamiltonian economic plan. Sorry for that. I could have screwed it up much better, could I?
I probably could have screwed it up even worse.
Well, I was holding it up against the computer screen, and what happened was it got transparent on me, so that wasn't a good idea. But, I mean, this is kind of harsh syntax, and yet actually – it's correct. I mean, when he says, once again, he said, acknowledging the viciousness and deviousness which characterized the Washington administration when it was threatened, or the class warfare which that administration waged against those who were to bear the brunt of, quote, development as envisioned by Hamiltonian economic plans. Now I feel better. But, I mean, those are two pretty heavy statements to make.
Yeah, they are. And I want people to realize that it seems like – at times it seems like we may be putting Montgomery and the Informer up on a pedestal. No. I'm giving credit where credit is due, because in all the years I've read and all the years I've learned, they really scraped away a lot of the crap and really delved into the origins of history. And they really cleared a lot of paths to where it all began. And they're the only two sources I've seen that did talk about the king and the pope. And when I really looked at it, and I really look at the whole thing with the Anti-Federalists, the Constitution, how things are today, I look back, I step back out, and I say, it all makes sense.
Yeah.
I've known like you that something was really not quite kosher. Something just wasn't right. Didn't pass the smell test, damn it. And now I look, and it's like I said, it all makes sense now.
There has been a toll taken by the government and by its allowance of corporate greed. And we see it today especially. If you never get caught in that vice, you really can't complain about the life you've had. And I also think that the degree of freedom one has is equal to the amount of money one has. If you're able not to get caught in any of the wine presses of tyranny in this country, it's a pretty good deal. And a lot of people would say, "What are you complaining about? Look at how everyone else has it." And I have to agree.
Same here.
I think what bothers me most, or in fact I know it, and that is the whitewashing of the origins of this country and its prime characters for a certain purpose that obviously has been used in this last century, and that is we can do no wrong, we have special dispensation with God, everybody was a Christian, and we're always right. And then you realize that's not true, but we all have carried that with us for quite some time, and that's why we brook some of the things that our country does in the form of using its military that kind of didn't make sense to us at times. And I think one of the things that rocked the boat big time was Vietnam, and I would say to a certain extent that the closer we get to a totalitarian situation, I think the sloppier that our government gets about trying to hide it from ourselves. After Vietnam and after what happened at Kent State.
I was going to say Kent State. You took the words right out of my mouth.
I mean, that was such an unbelievably, just an incredible overuse of power. And the whole thing was screwed up. I mean, I'm not blaming the guardsmen altogether, but the thing is, that kind of response to what was going on was uncalled for, and the people that were sent there to quell a riot probably weren't using the best common sense, neither were their officers, by the way, and they were ill-equipped to do such a thing. But for that to have happened, that just kind of ended, I would say, protest in America. You'll see some stuff pop up here and there, but nothing like there was back then. And it was almost if the powers that be, and Nixon in particular, doing the bidding of his masters, was saying, this crap ain't ever happening again.
Well, which brings me right back to the Whiskey Rebellion. Washington and Hamilton, they formed over 10,000 militia troops. And even amongst the troops, there were divisions of class and money where you had some of the officers and better troops. They slept dry. They were well fed. They had their boots. They had their tents. They had kind of sort of some of the comforts of home, whereas you had the lower income troops. They had no shoes. They were walking. This was in a cold fall in Pennsylvania. And, you know, needless to say, there was a hell of a lot of resentment towards the better off guys. And Washington and Hamilton did travel with the troops, and it was really a shock and awe effort. The rebels, and it was primarily in four Pennsylvania counties, as I mentioned in previous installments. And Hamilton and Washington had this attitude that the basic farmers, the unwashed masses, really, you know, they couldn't pour urine out of a boot if the instructions were printed on the heel. They couldn't manage themselves. They couldn't govern themselves. They were basically stupid. They were incompetent. They were filthy, unkempt. And they needed the elite to take care of them. One sign of the rebellion was what was called liberty poles. I'm not exactly sure what they were. I mean, of course, a pole is a pole, but was it made of pine? Was it made of maple? You know, was it made of lath that was secured into the ground? I need to do a little bit more research on that. But some of these liberty poles had the rebels' flag, and it was an affair with six stripes or something like that. But they would leave these liberty poles, and they would attack these excise officials. They would tar and feather them, run them out of town, harass them. Sometimes they would wear black face paint, which was a British lower-class method of intimidation. And Washington and Hamilton, you know, when they were chasing these rebels, they promised amnesty, which really they didn't give. And the one thing that saved the rebels was jury nullification. Many of these indictments went to trial. And here you've got these guys, these rebels, saying, well, we want our constitutional rights, because this was shortly after the Constitution was ratified. Basically, Washington and Hamilton told them to go pound sand, you know, as far as freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, right to redress. You know, from the very beginning, Washington and Hamilton were truly hypocrites in that, you know, they came across with this document, but they themselves, the supposed creators of this document, and of course we know that that wasn't true, they adopted it, but they didn't even give these guys the time of day. And jury nullification was really what is really the force that prevented many of these guys from either meeting up with the gallows or prison. Now, I believe there were two convictions. Washington did pardon the convicted individuals. There was an individual who was known as Herman Husband, and he went by the name of Tom the Tinker. And I can read another excerpt, if that's all right, from this very treatise. The rebels also had a plan, a revision of how this better world might look. It was put forth in the writing and preaching of Herman Husband, one of the most remarkable of the rebels. In the 1760s, Husband had helped to foment another rebellion against the landed authority of the colony of North Carolina. Forced to flee, this educated farmer-turned-preacher-writer hid deep in the Allegheny wilderness of Bedford County, Pennsylvania, taking to heart the lessons of the American Revolution. A great champion of radical democracy, Husband spoke to and for the landless, the poor farmer with a bit of land, the village artisans, and the other members of the Western lower class. He was dismissed as a crank by members of the elite. Albert Gallatin thought of him as the crazy man of Bedford, while Hugh Henry Brackenridge, who had visited him in 1780 and had heard some of his preaching on Ezekiel and what Husband called, quote, the New Jerusalem, unquote, thought that Husband's church is composed, like many others, of the ignorant and the dissembling. Let me interject a quick note here. Brackenridge wrote a play that I'm sure J.Q. would be quite interested in. Continuing here. When the rebel crowd at the crucial August 14th Parkinson's Ferry meeting selected Husband along with Gallatin and Brackenridge, plus Bradford, for the committee to put their resolutions into good readable shape, Brackenridge thought not of allying with Husband, but only that he could make, quote, use of Herndon Husband to amuse Bradford with him, unquote. That is, aristocratically, to manipulate Husband as though he were a toy or a curiosity in order to gain some needed time. Middling and elite people literally could not hear Husband's message. At Husband's later federal court trial, prosecution witness Robert Smiley echoed the class sensibility of Gallatin when he chuckled that Husband had written, quote, some foolish things about the New Jerusalem, unquote. But Husband's neighbor and fellow Bedford farmer James Wilson, a witness for the defense, calmly stated that Husband was, quote, employed in writing upon prophets and making riddles, unquote, and had, quote, found the situation of New Jerusalem to be at Kentucky, unquote. He had an idea, Husband, that his goal was a society, New Jerusalem, sort of an extended commentary on the biblical prophet Ezekiel. You know, his goal was truly an egalitarian, distributed plan for the landless, laborer, small farmer. You know, there was an element of racism, but he did believe that even women of the time should get equal shares of land. So he in many respects was a man ahead of his time. He was in prison for a very long time, and he died a bitter man. But he was a key player in the Whiskey Rebellion, Herman Husband.
Yeah. Now, are you taking it from that paper?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, because, you know, I thought it interesting, too, because as it said at the end of that paper, you know, try to find any, well, as the author said, I've carefully searched both papers for the years 1794 and 95 and found almost no mention of the rebellion. So there's your news blackout right there. Starting again at that time and carrying on to this day, because, you know, I don't know how we must have seen it as a paragraph or so, like maybe in our junior American history books, you know, Shays Rebellion, Whiskey Rebellion. Yeah, okay, it's a paragraph or so, blah, blah, blah. Go ahead. Go move on. Never understanding what the underlying principles involved in that. So, yeah, it's mentioned just so that it's mentioned, but it's not much is said about it. But one other thing I just want to mention before you go onward, and that is back to that graph, because you just mentioned it with what Husbands was trying to get across, and that was, what would you call it, a non-racial, non-class distinction, non-sexist type of treatment of people. And as it said in this paper, and also Jerry Frisia in his book Toward an American Revolution states these same things. And how is it also that Christians seem to just pass by this with regard to the way the Constitution beheld people and who had the right to vote? I think being a citizen would be one of the criteria, but it wasn't. It was about money, and it was about being a landed male, a landed white male. But anyway,
that's correct.
Let me knock this sentence off, because it just as embraces what you said, and you'll make me happy, and I'll be done. So the mainstream has for 200 years ignored the radical democratic and communal, and in parentheses, if racist and sexist, end of parentheses, vision of themselves and their future held by many American farmers, artisans, and common laborers in the 1780s and 1790s, to say nothing of the continuing resistance such groups have always demonstrated toward the plans of American elites. Indeed, in the supposedly democratic United States, the mere existence, much less the historical importance and power, of those at the bottom of the social and economic scale gets mostly negative attention. I'll let it go with that. But, you know, and here's another thing, too, which is another canard. And so, I mean, even the lexicon that we use to describe ourselves and what kind of system of government we have is still off. And that is, a democracy is what you don't want. And all of a sudden, democracy has become a good word. Everybody's, well, we have a democracy. We have a democracy. Well, first of all, you really don't. But secondly, you don't want that.
You know why you really don't want a democracy, Al? Because the majority is never right.
Well, just think of this, okay? If the people who have access and policymaking privileges to slant the news, censor the news, you know, gatekeep the news, what gets in, what gets out, what doesn't get in, what doesn't get out, then you have the informational advantage, and that's what you share with the mass, right? The thing is, if you can propagandize them into believing your spiel, then you can say we want a democracy because you propagandized the masses into believing something that's not true.
Thank you. That's exactly right. And especially today. Even back then, during the Anti-Federalists times, when you had the Federalists buying up a lot of the presses, they were buying up the print houses, and they were taking any Anti-Federalist stuff and basically either throwing them into the fireplace or the round file.
And I would submit to you that the power over the people back then, and let's take it right through the Civil War, was such that I would say that there was no way in the world you could agitate two sections of this country enough to get them to fight one another unless the power of the press wasn't involved in it. You know what I mean?
Sure, with plenty of financing to back them up, not to mention the European intrigues that really were behind a lot of it.
Exactly. In other words, I don't think you could agitate two groups of people separated by some latitude line to go and kill each other.
Yeah, as you've said before, just put, you know, basically scratch both their asses with sandpaper and throw them into the ring.
Right. And, you know, and that's what happened. But it had to be worked at, because I don't think that necessarily you would get people actuated like that. Certainly you wouldn't see anything happening in small pockets, because obviously if the Whiskey Rebellion didn't work in the late 18th century, well, what do we expect to work, like what, another 50 years later? Nothing.
Right, and look at the Treaty of Verona. Could the Civil War have been an outgrowth, long-awaited outgrowth, of at least part of that philosophy?
What are we talking about now? We got the two things I always get mixed up. It's the Council of Vienna and the Secret Treaty of Verona. Does that sound right?
Yes.
Around 1820.
I think, what was it, 1822 was the Treaty of Verona.
Right, the Secret Treaty of Verona, and the Congress of Vienna was right around that time, too, and they both were related to a certain extent, which is like whatever happened in the United States ain't happening here. So.
Yeah, and I believe it was you and Theo you were talking about. I think it was you and Theo who were talking about, you know, instead of calling it the Treaty of Rome, use a bit of backhanded subterfuge and camouflage to say it was the Treaty of Verona.
Right. All starts with a V.
Yeah.
But I mean, and that's what, you know, JQ covers, and we're all aware of the parties that were in play at that time. But it was we kind of don't look across the pond after our revolution, because you kind of like just take care of your own business, or you look at what we were doing. But what was going on in Europe was also fascinating. And, I mean, to this day, it still has ramifications. It's just an interesting one, I guess, solid concatenation of intrigues that lasted until, I guess, about 1850 or so. And I think it's more by the fact that Britain and France fought together for the first time in the War of the Crimea. So it only took them to 1848. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. And the idea of husbands, to go to husbands, New Jerusalem, he felt it was the real goal of the American Revolution. And, you know, and really it was he, in a way, was spitting on the shoe of the elites, you know, Washington and his government, you know, the elite Senate Constitution, because, you know, as I was saying earlier, you know, the labor, the small guy, the little people, he was really their champion. And, you know, workers' cooperatives he wanted, you know, an economic interest, you know, so everybody owned a little piece of it. I mean, could you call it socialist? I don't honestly know. But it's like anything else. What's the intent of it? You know, really, what's the intent of it? You know, it's just like, you know, a hammer could be a tool to construct or a tool to destruct. You know, and he defined exploitation as one man living off the labor of hundreds. And he saw, you know, an economy, he called it commercial wage labor, that was emerging. So what he wanted was land ownership for every person, man, woman, and child. And he would have limited each family to 2,000 acres. Any excess would be confiscated and redistributed. He thought that the government in a democratic republic had a moral obligation to aid everybody, not just a few at the top, not just the money douchebags, as I like to call them, but yes, everybody. And the New Jerusalem, he said one of the chief purposes was to establish what he called administrative agencies. And these would regulate the sources of the exploitation, you know, land distribution, commerce. And he also, you know, was in favor of a broad public education. And here's where he was really ahead of his time, and who knows whether the actual original 13th Amendment was an outgrowth of his idea. I don't really know this. Any public office would be denied. I mean, they could vote. You know, suffrage was to be very broad, very far-reaching. But lawyers, merchants, tavern keepers, he didn't think had the common interest at heart. And public access over the regulatory agencies of government. So in many respects, this guy was way ahead of his time.
Yeah.
But he fell afoul of Washington and Hamilton, and he ended up in prison. So, you know, where were his constitutional rights?
Yeah, freedom of expression. They were thrown. Right.
What's that?
No, I mean freedom of expression. Like, what, you know, where was that honored on his behalf? Not at all.
Not at all. No.
So he became a political, ideological prisoner because of what he had to say.
That's correct.
Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. I mean, they talked about all this blah, 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 about freedom of expression. We've gone over this ad nauseum. How many times, you know, there is no freedom of expression. There's no freedom of speech. If most people don't like what you say, they either want to kill you or censor you or send you to a loony bin. So let's stop with all the talk about freedom of expression. You pay a price if you're in a minority view.
That's so true. And Washington and Hamilton, you know, Theo and I talked about this last time, where you had there were thousands of what could be called squatters on Washington's land. He was so busy speculating and being an absentee landlord that he threw well over 1,000, you know, settlers off of his land. These were Scots, they'd offered to buy the land. Washington basically told them to pound sand and he walked out. So he had these people thrown off their land, so here they are trying to scrape a living off of it. So what's all this about these yearning, you know, these huddled masses yearning to be free?
Yes.
I mean, it's a lot of crap. I'm sorry, but it's a lot of friggin' crap.
Well, it's worse because it starts with him. And the elevation that he has had of almost a near deity. And I had a laugh about this stuff about, well, he could have been a monarch, but he turned it down. He was a monarch. He didn't have to turn it down. The Constitution allowed it to be that way. And every other president, when it suits our social engineers' desire to do something, forget the Constitution. I mean, it allows this, but on the other hand, it's a piece of paper, or as Theo has said about parchment worship, where it actually allows itself to be ignored.
So. Yes. Washington had anger issues throughout his life. And he really had a tough time controlling his temper. throughout much of his life. And there was a presentation I saw on the internet, and I really had to choke it down because there was so much hero worship in it. And frankly, I was getting a little pissed off watching it because a lot of the stuff that I've learned here, this guy didn't even touch. You know, he was too busy, you know, swabbing rumps as opposed to standing back and really offering some pointed analysis of what really happened. But this whole myth of Washington and the cherry tree was just that. It was a myth.
Well, you know, think back, honestly, when we were in grammar school, you were like, eh, bullshit. I mean, that was so lily white. It was like, get out of here with that. But we went with it. We got a day off from school. We can live with that.
Sure. Well, it's... What was that saying that you mentioned not too long ago? Conspiracy is what?
What do you mean? Is it history you don't know about?
That's it.
Yeah, the only conspiracy is the history you don't know about, which is a subtitle to this program, by the way, Eric.
I have a good memory. Al, I have a good memory. It's just short.
Yeah. But it's true. I mean, and I ripped that off from Harry Truman, who said the only thing new is the history you don't know about.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, I just tweaked and said the only conspiracy is the history you don't know about. And that's exactly what it is.
Yep. Let me read one more excerpt from this excellent, this superb treatise. It is easy to understand how the whiskey rebels thought well of Husband's message, since it was conceived from the same history and within his experience of the same difficulties they encountered and understood. It answered their deep needs, promising them land, autonomy, community control of government, and especially termination of the exploitation they suffered from an enveloping, oppressive, propertied and commercial, moneyed, elite-controlled economy. It was founded upon an Enlightenment-generated recognition of personal human dignity, a vision they shared for themselves and thought they deserved from the American community at large, and which they had bled and died for during the American Revolution. Very important sentence. Husband's New Jerusalem also shared the racist colonialism of the rebels' elite oppressors by excluding black and red people from its notion of community, and it continued the sexism of most of Western European society in denying women the vote. It did, surprisingly, grant women ownership rights in land equal to men, a harbinger of the kind of progressive enlargement of the Enlightenment-based notions of humanity and equality, which has actually occurred through great struggle in the equally Enlightenment-based dominant United States culture during the two centuries which separate us from Husband and his whiskey rebels. From its time, it was an extremely progressive vision of egalitarian, democratic, socialist, worker-centered community. Unquote. So it had its warts. There's no doubt about it. It had its warts, but it was far, far more common person friendly.
Okay.
Than what the Constitution envisioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Frazier said in that book you can read online, Toward an American Revolution. Excuse me. You know, how is it that we're such a Christian nation? And yet we don't want to give the vote to minorities, women, or, as I said before, white males unless they're landed. So right then and there, there's an elitism that's taken place. And here's another one for you, if you can remember this. This is one of the big head scratchers I think we all faced a little bit when we were in grammar school or at least getting into junior high school when they were trying to tell us about the Electoral College. Explain this to me, please. So in other words, you get to a point where a lot of my classmates or whatever would say, all right, so in other words, when we vote, we really don't vote for the president because the electorate can go ahead and vote for whomever or who he or she wishes. So it's almost as if the Electoral College, as I looked at it, was, all right, folks, you can have the vote, but in case you screw it up, we'll take care of it with the Electoral College. And, I mean, that's the only thing I can see, really. I mean, the purpose for it. And that's when they finally screwed around with it in Rutherford v. Hayes' victory over Samuel Tilden.
That's right.
An electorate flipped or whatever. But, of course, nonpartisan Republicans went down and did a recount, and Hayes won. So it's amazing.
How convenient.
And they pulled the same, and I know we talked about this. We covered this ground. I won't belabor it. But what happened in 2000 was the exact same thing that happened in 1876. They just used Louisiana, and they were ready to use Florida if they had to.
Oh, sure. Well, Kennedy and Nixon, maybe? Also, wasn't there Dewey and Truman?
Well, those particular elections are the things that go bump during the night, yeah. But it was the recount thing I'm talking about with bipartisan committees going down. And I said that, you know, William Christopher went down and they did and of course they found out that Bush had won because he was supposed to win. Well, when Garfield led that group down to Louisiana, I mean, that was mostly Republican. And guess what? They found out that, Rutherford B. Hayes did win. That's all I mean. I mean, in that sense, they actually had real recounts. But I think what we're referring to with regard to Kennedy and Nixon was that something just funky happened overnight. You know what I mean? They never really called for a recount that I know of. I don't remember. I don't think they did that. It was just like, oops, gee, yeah. Well, we had a recount. Well, they had to retabulate the votes in Cook County in which Chicago lies. But I mean, going down and actually doing a recount with a committee, 2000, like, that was done in 1876. And, and as I said before, there was some, real concerns that this chicanery was so obvious, which it really wasn't in the end, was so obvious that they thought that the South would start up another Civil War. So you can imagine that, you know, 11 years after or 12 years after it's over. So in other words, their thought about what kind of crap they were pulling on Louisiana might be so obvious that it could trigger, and it wasn't. I mean, they just sweep it under the rug and life went on. But no, I mean, the other elections that we were talking about, 2000, even 2004, same thing happened in East Ohio.
Right.
So, and that's why I always felt that the manipulators of the vote are never going to make those kind of mistakes again because those are two scares right in a row. And actually, Bush didn't get elected in 2000, 2004. And, I mean, not that we care. Whoever, you know, goat they put in there, it doesn't matter to us.
Sure, six of one, half a dozen of the other.
But going back to what we were saying from the very beginning, trying to learn American history early on, the Electoral College was like, what? Okay, I guess.
Well, the excuse given is, well, it gives the heartland an equal vote. I mean, is that true?
I don't think so.
I don't know.
Well, I mean,
I don't honestly know. Because, well, everybody and his brother could vote for candidate A, and if the Electoral College decides to vote for candidate B, well, guess who wins? Candidate B.
Yeah, I don't really buy that it gives the less populous states a heavier clout. Because when you do look at elections, especially in the latter half of the 19th century into the 20th, I mean, you see a lot of losers that piled up a lot of votes. And so the popular vote was kind of close. And then you look at the Electoral College, and it's like, holy mackerel, he got massacred. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's like, oh, you did great with the population, but in states that don't count. Anyway, without belaboring any longer, it was almost as if they were telling us, you're too stupid to vote, so we'll take care of it if you screw up. That's how I look at it.
Well, I think that's the attitude that Washington, and especially Hamilton, had back during the time of the delegation and the convention. And do you realize that almost no resistance was offered the army when they went out to tackle the whiskey rebels? And this was the rebellion was really more widespread than people think it was. It wasn't really just confined to those four Pennsylvania counties, although that's really where most of the activity was happening. But people saw the Constitution for what it was, and I think my belief is that, based on what I've studied, they realized that they'd bought a bill of goods.
Oh, yeah.
And they could see the handwriting on the wall, and they were very upset about it. But the army, and here's a quote, met no resistance either in the mountains or in the infected district. Not a dog wagged his tongue against the army. Not a single shot was fired. The Liberty Poles continued to sprout up in the army's path. the people of the West were now either frightened or cowed or repentant. And there were cheers for the army after this whole thing was taken, you know, after this whole thing was done. But doesn't it kind of dovetail with what we've talked about? And here were people who had muskets against the government's muskets, but they were so intimidated by sheer numbers that they just basically threw their muskets down and said, you know, no mas, no mas.
Well, there's a second part to that equation. You have to have like weaponry, and you also have to have the same number.
That's correct.
All right, just having like weaponry without having the numbers, it doesn't matter.
No, of course.
But you know what I'm wondering, too? I mean, Pennsylvania was a state by then, but the western part of Pennsylvania was as basically unsettled and as frontier as Ohio, just across the Monongahela or whatever, the Ohio River.
Yep.
And I'm just wondering, too, if the reason why Washington and Hamilton went out, I'm just wondering if that was supposed to be some kind of a shot across the bow of the Native Americans. Is it to say, we're going to be back here later on, so just get used to this?
I believe that to be the case.
Now, what you had said that intrigued me, I guess two shows ago, it turned out that the Native American peoples who kicked a little booty were the Miamis, as I thought they might be, correct?
Yes, I believe that's true.
Yeah, the Miamis, because that
and the Creek. The Creek Indians, too, they were involved as
they
well.
They were also, okay. But my point is that I just wonder if I mean, why would your executive, commander-in-chief, chief executive go out there, and Hamilton, too? I mean, with that, to me, it just seems like a show of force that says, okay, we're really going out, we're going out to quell this rebellion, but it's almost like they're looking around and saying, I hope other sets of eyes are watching us, because we'll be back this way again. So,
yeah. Well, and that's, you know, the stated goal and the actual goal. It's just like with the Lewis and Clark expedition. I mean, Jefferson was really looking for a westward canal that went from the Ohio out to the Pacific, if I remember right. And he said, well, I really just want to study the land and find out, you know, the different indigenous peoples and the flora and the fauna and this kind of thing. When really, if my reading of it is correct, the real warp and weft of this whole thing was financial. He was looking for a trade route from the Ohio that went directly out to the Pacific.
Is this otherwise known as the Northwest Passage?
I believe so. At some point, I'd love to talk about the Battle of Fort Griswold, which was in my neck of the woods. It was in September of 1781, if memory serves. It involved our old friend Benedict Arnold, and I wouldn't mind touching upon that in a future program, future show. But I found a great book, Whiskey Rebels, The Story of a Frontier Uprising by Leland D. Baldwin. I got it yesterday. I've just had a chance to maybe read part of chapter one. And the original came out in 1939, University of Pittsburgh Press. And it looks like a pretty interesting read. And I'm definitely gonna take a look at this one. And there's a lot of detail in here. The little details and minutiae and all the intrigues and efforts, and how many pages? There's over 300 pages here. So I wanted to mention that as well.
Well, you can read that in one sitting in the bathroom, can't you?
There you go.
Yeah, maybe two.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you also, because I think we touched upon this a little bit, but I didn't know if you wanted to give it any further treatment, the Judiciary Act?
Yes. The Judiciary Act. Here you've got in the Constitution, this Section 1, you know, it gives Congress, they basically got a blank slate. They could create any system of federal courts they wanted. And I'll read this quote from the Constitution. The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. That's it. You know, I mean, they didn't really specify the number of Supreme Court justices. You know, Congress, I mean, they can monkey with that number, and they have for years, from 6 to 5, to 7 to 9, to 10, to 7 to 9. And then basically our good old friend FDR in 37, he came close to packing the court, you know, with extra justices. And then you've got the appellate jurisdictions, you know, such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. I mean, that's big enough to drive in a cell a train through.
But we kidded about that to a certain extent, and that is we were told that the Constitution is a living document and it's interpreted differently, and really what we translated that as, I think the three of us were in accord, and that means baloney, man. The thing is so open-ended that you make it do whatever you want to at any time.
Sure. Now, I don't know if I read this in the last program with Theo, but this was a 17th January 1788 letter to Yates. This was anti-federalist Melancton Smith. He had some fears, and this is what he said. Quote, "It appears to me the judiciary is so framed as to clinch all the other powers and to extend them in a silent and imperceptible manner to anything and everything, while the court, who are vested with these powers, are totally independent, uncontrollable, and not amenable to any other power in any decisions they may make," unquote. My apologies if I read that last time, but I think it's so apropos, it bears repeating anyway. Because this act, I mean, the Constitution had something like, what is it, about 4,500? This behemoth contained about 8,500 words, this Judiciary Act.
Yeah.
And Ralph Borsinski in The Constitution That Never Was, his book, he goes into considerable detail on this Judiciary Act. So, you know, you've got lawyers. They will refuse to convict fellow citizens, you know, and basically it gives the lawyers the pick of the litter. They can do whatever they want. And isn't it interesting that that whole original 13th Amendment was kiboshed so quickly?
By the way, and again, here's a little more esoteric information. Kelly had sent me an excerpt from a book back around the mid-19th century or so, maybe a little bit earlier. So we're looking at, I don't know, 1830s to 50s or something like that. And apparently in Brazil, there were all these nation states before Brazil was Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember the name of the particular territory. It could be La Plata or something or other. I don't know. I would have to take a look. But what struck me and struck him is ironic was that one of the planks in their ruling document was no titles of nobility in government. I swear to you, this is great.
Oh, wow. No kidding.
So you have these South Americans like, nah, we don't want this either. And England had tried to get in there a little bit, but it kind of didn't work out. And they just said, we won't mess with it anymore. I read that for a time. And, you know, it's one of these things you get lost in. Because this is another, and it is a very small, and I mean, for us it is because we don't live in Brazil, but I mean, it's just something we don't hear much about. But there was a time when, I guess it was these city-states or nation-states, whatever you want to call them, and, you know, a loose aggregation of entities. And they were trying to kind of form something, and England was trying to get in there, and it got repelled a little bit. But I just thought it was funny because they just didn't want any titles of nobility in government.
Yeah, the Federalists. I mean, do you realize they delayed ratification of the Bill of Rights for over 2 years? I mean, I bet they did that because they wanted to organize these new federal courts. They wanted to get the judges all set up with these powers and all these perquisites to throw individual rights into the garbage can.
Well, if the Bill of Rights isn't for them, I mean, isn't for the people
anyway. No, it's not. But even, you know, on its face, you know, even if you look at it for its face value, it's a will of the wisp. You know, and this was the bar. Here's something. You know, the power of the courts to, quote, punish by fine or imprisonment at the discretion of said courts all contempts of authority in any cause or hearing before the same, unquote. So basically, you know, a judge can hit anybody at any time for any reason with contempt of court.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And that's why when we were saying, when Theo and I did It's About Totalitarianism, Stupid, it's like with these sovereign citizens, you can be right, and I understand why you would be right. But it doesn't matter if they're not going to play by that rule. And they change the rules as they go.
Right. And Theo sent an interesting link to a YouTube video.
I saw it.
I didn't get a chance to see it, but every time these guys try to pull this sovereign stuff, it seems like they just, you know, they're trying to walk around in a room full of marbles with hard-soled shoes.
In this last case, first of all, if what they said were true all the way through, you would have anarchy. Because what it comes down to is do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Seriously.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And that can't be. So I understand. I mean, you can take this argument to the point where everybody's, you know, a nation unto themselves and a law unto themselves. And you can't run a society like that. If you want to live in the woods by yourself, I guess that'll work. Yeah, no problem. And like I said, on face, I really don't have a problem with it. But when you try to put it into practicality and you have no power because you are not a judge, you are not involved in the courts, then they're going to go ahead and slam you every time. I mean, I don't know if you got that email I sent around that had to do with my reading about that character, quote, Arthur, who tried to bust a move on the IRS and now he's in prison.
Yes. Yes, I believe you and Theo did a show about that.
Well,
at least touched upon it,
yeah.
You know.
But, I mean, the latter thing is this. I mean, here's the irony of it. The gentleman had a very, very good job with FedEx, and he didn't like paying taxes to the Crown, right? So
right.
So now the person who's passed that information along said, so, I mean, in a sense, he didn't say it was the irony, but it is an irony that now he's paying 100% of his salary to the government.
Yeah, wasn't he a cargo pilot? I mean, he had the world by the short hairs.
Right. So in other words, he balked at how much he had to pay to the government. Now he's paying it all to the government because he happened to be in a federal prison.
Right. So, not only financially, but temporally. He's there. His time is spent there.
Yeah.
So it's just like with Kojak with his bald head and lollipop. When one of his colleagues went bad and he was like lying dead in a ditch and Kojak had just sort of had this rueful smile, and he looked down on his old friend, and he just asked, "Was it worth it, baby?"
Yeah, and that's the whole thing. So I don't know what you want to get yourself thrown into a high tower for, but if that's what it is, that's fine. And like I said, right doesn't matter with these characters because they run a different show. You can get ignorance on a lower level where it won't work, and it should. And then you get the federal judges who will tell you, no, no way, man. We're not doing that here. That is not happening.
Yeah.
That's the way it goes.
I mean, my main observance about the Constitution was it basically it just cut the courts totally loose so they could do whatever they wanted.
But they are
along
also
with the president, of course.
Yeah, but I mean, they're also dictator too. That's just it. I mean.
Oh yeah, they are.
So I mean, whatever they do is meant to be as well. So the Supreme Court. Doesn't matter who you got on it, it's going to come out with the decisions that it's meant to come out with. Same thing with who's president. Doesn't matter what party's in there. They come out with the same situation that they're supposed to regardless. Are the parties different? Yes, they both pop off with a different ideology, but in the end they take you to the same place.
Sure.
So, but
how are we doing for time?
All right, well, we got about 3 minutes left.
Okay.
Make my day.
I wanted to get into Shay's Rebellion. I'll touch upon it now, but definitely prime it for a future installment.
Okay.
And I have a statement from somebody of the time. I won't read the whole thing. I'll just read the headline from it. A little excerpt. William Manning, a laborer, explains Shay's Rebellion in Massachusetts in as plain a manner as I am capable. I'll send you this link along with some others that I came across.
Okay.
The end of the War of Independence in 1783 curtailed wartime loss of life and destruction of property. However, peace also brought economic distress through cycles of depression and glut. These cycles were exacerbated when Massachusetts authorities pursued strict policies on money and debt, and British creditors called in their debts during the post-revolutionary depression. when merchants turned to already pressured farmers and rural traders who had no cash to pay their debts or taxes, courts and jails filled with debtors. In protest, Daniel Shays, a former captain in the Revolutionary Militia, led an uprising in western and central Massachusetts to close the courts and prevent the seizure of property for unpaid debts. Massachusetts Governor Bowdoin sent a military force that scattered the rebels. In his 1799 treatise to his fellow working men and women, William Manning offered a history of Shays' rebellion along with his prescription for avoiding such insurrections in the future by an organization of working people. Now, this is copied. You know, it's kind of like I'd like to see the original to see if there's been any editing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try to find the original written treatise if I can find it. But like Paul Harvey used to say, next time I'll tell the rest of the story, because there is more to the story of Shays' Rebellion that I was unaware of.
Okay. And, yeah, I had sent you that one file, too, that we came from, I guess, what, Western New England University?
Yes.
All right.
Interesting stuff. And I'd like to end with this one excerpt from – it's funny. I said, geez, you know, I just picked a federal farmer. You mentioned Kismet. Well, he did talk about Shays' Rebellion.
Okay. Sure.
And I see the danger in either case will arise principally from the conduct and views of two very unprincipled parties in the United States. Two fires between which the honest and substantial people have long found themselves situated. One party is composed of little insurgents, men in debt, who want no law and who want a share of the property of others. These are called revelers, Shayites, etc. The other party is composed of a few, but more dangerous men with their servile dependents. These avariciously grasp at all power and property. You may discover in all the actions of these men an evident dislike to free and equal government, and they will go systematically to work to change, essentially, the forms of government in this country. These are called aristocrats, monarchists, etc. Between these two parties is the weight of the community, the men of middling property, men not in debt on the one hand, and men on the other content with republican governments and not aiming in immense fortunes, offices, and power. In 1786, the little insurgents, the revelers, came forth, invaded the rights of others, and attempted to establish governments according to their wills. Their movements evidently gave encouragement to the other party, which, in 1787, has taken the political field, and with it, its fashionable dependents, and the tongue in the pen, is endeavoring to establish in a great haste a politer kind of government. And there's more. But it seems like Shays' Rebellion was certainly a catalyst to getting the Constitutional Convention going, because it did freak out the elites. And this is Federalists, let's see here, Federalist number 37 by the Federal Farmer. And the title is Factions and the Constitution.
All right, and with that, I will bid you adieu, and I'll see you next time.
A million old soldiers will fade away.